afternoon. We have one appeal to hear this afternoon, Guardado versus the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. Mr. Gunn, will you come and speak with us?
May it please the court, Sean Gunn, Assistant Federal Public Defender for Appellant Jesse Guardado. What I'd like to do is start with making a few points about the mitigation ineffectiveness claim and then turn to the juror ineffectiveness claim. As to mitigation ineffectiveness, Your Honors, this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly reaffirmed that counsel has a duty to conduct a, quote, thorough investigation for mitigating evidence in a capital case. That's not what happened in this case. Here, counsel was appointed solely for the penalty phase 9 months before the proceedings began and was granted co-counsel, an investigator, and expert funds. But counsel unreasonably stopped the investigation after taking three steps. Number one, counsel obtained a letter from the Walton County Sheriff stating that Mr. Guardado had no disciplinary infractions while in pretrial detention. Number two, counsel interviewed Mr. Guardado, two family members, a former employer, and a former girlfriend, but obtained little to no useful mitigation, aside from a letter from Mr. Guardado's mother, which was submitted to the jury but not read to the jury. And three, counsel selected Dr. Larson as his expert and received a brief report a month before the penalty phase. But that report found no statutory mitigation. It found that Mr. Guardado suffers from no mental illnesses, no emotional disorders, and that he was in control of his actions on the night of the murder. Contrary to the Florida Supreme Court's decision, this counsel's decision to end his investigation at this point was unreasonable.
Can you show me where in the 3.850 motion that Mr. Guardado's counsel below argued a lack of investigation?
In the 3851 proceedings?
Yeah. Not the proceedings, the motion. I have a copy in front of me of the 3850 motion and the memorandum of law that was filed that set out the claims that were actually litigated before the state habeas court.
I don't have a citation in the motion for you. I may when I stand back up, but I know that it was argued throughout the proceedings and in the Florida Supreme Court, and the Florida Supreme Court addressed that issue.
Well, please do take a look at it. It's a docket entry 17-24. I just don't see any mention at all, both in the state habeas court order and in the state habeas motion, the 3851 motion, where it was ever said that there was a lack of investigation. In fact, the claim number three there, is the failure to call certain character witnesses. And there, it is specifically alleged, quote, each witness was known to defense counsel well prior to trial and was willing and available to testify. That doesn't seem like a failure to investigate claim. That seems like a failure to call witnesses that counsel did know about claim.
Right. Well, I think the claim was broken into two below.
It was.
There was a failure to expand the investigation as to the mental health evidence, as to Dr. Larson. And then it was sort of separated into a separate bucket for failure to call mitigation witnesses. I mean, of course, this court's grant of a COA was whether counsel was ineffective in failing to investigate and present. So to the extent
what that... There was the rest of that. What was the rest of that?
On the condition that the specific factual basis and legal theories were presented to the state courts.
That's exactly right.
I would just point out that the Florida Supreme Court found no sort of default as to that issue, and they addressed it on the merits. So we would rely on that and as to the COA. I would just like to highlight some key points from the trial record and from the post-conviction record that demonstrate trial counsel's ineffectiveness. And I'll start with the trial record. Counsel didn't call anybody who knew Mr. Guardado. They submitted the letter from the mother. And the only other witness they called was Dr. Larson. And his testimony only covered certain aspects of his report. And at this point, the Larson report had leads to mitigation evidence that should have been followed up on. For instance, the report notes that Mr. Guardado suffered two major traumas in his life. There was no testimony from Dr. Larson regarding any kind of trauma. Dr. Larson's report stated that a major feature of Mr. Guardado's psychological profile was his long incarceration history.
I think the question that I'd like to focus on, and I don't want to cut you off,
sure.
but to me it's the question that I'm focused on for answering is the prejudice side of it.
Okay.
Because what the district court did is the district court laid out exhaustively, in my view, all of the evidence that was presented at the mitigation stage, both in front of the jury and to the judge at the Spencer hearing, and then laid out all the evidence that was brought out at the evidentiary hearing in the front of the 3851 court. And there, when you compare the two, it's hard to see, and focus me on it, where there would be prejudice and where it's not reasonable the state trial court to have applied Strickland to conclude or determine that there was no prejudice when you compare those two things. Can you focus me on that?
Sure. Thanks. And I accept that a comparative analysis is appropriate in part, comparing the post-conviction evidence to the trial evidence. I would say that the Strickland standard focuses on an objectively reasonable counsel.
So that's on the deficiency side, and that's why I'm focusing on the prejudice side. So yes, I'm assuming for the moment that there are deficiencies, some of the ones you've raised.
Sure.
I'm talking about what prejudice there could be. In other words, how is it unreasonable for the state court to determine that there was no reasonable probability of a different outcome?
Okay.
If this evidence that was presented at the 3851 hearing had in fact come in?
Well, what I would say is the post-conviction evidence through Dr. Pritchard and Ms. Johnson altered the sentencing profile in this way. Dr. Larson found that Mr. Guardado, as I mentioned, suffers no mental illnesses. On the other hand, Dr. Pritchard and Ms. Johnson established that he does suffer a mental illness. Dr. Larson found that he was not in control the night of the murder. Dr. Pritchard and Ms. Johnson found that he was unable to conform his actions and he was suffering from extreme emotional disturbance.
But if you look at the sentencing order, and I'm sorry to jump in there, but if you look at the sentencing order was clear that the defendant, quote, was under emotional distress during the time frame of the crime. That's at docket entry 17-6 at page 29. And in multiple specific parts found that he had suffered and was suffering from a crack addiction, which did affect him at the time of the crime. Those are the same exact things that Ms. Johnson and Dr. Pritchard were testifying to. Now, their conclusion was those were statutory as opposed to non-statutory mitigators, but I'm having trouble understanding how that's prejudice such that there's a reasonable probability that would have resulted in a different outcome at sentence.
Well, so the sentencing order was based on counsel had requested a single non-statutory mitigator related to mental health, and the sentencing court essentially just found that one drug-related mitigator. And Dr. Larson, in his report, did say that Mr. Guardado was under some degree of distress at the time, but as you said, did not rise to the level of statutory mitigation.
Here's what the court found. It said the defendant has suffered most of his adult life with an addiction problem to crack cocaine, comma, which was the basis of his criminal actions. That's at 17-6 at page 27.
That's true, but during Dr. Larson's test, remember that the jury never had Dr. Larson's report. So during Dr. Larson's testimony, he at one point contradicts himself and says he doesn't even consider Mr. Guardado to be a crack expert addict.
But he did testify that he relapsed and went on a crack cocaine binge and was under considerable stress. Right.
Yes. But I think those were pretty bare assertions in his testimony and in the report that didn't have any context behind them. So the jury heard the bad side of the double edge to drug mitigation there. They heard what it made him do and the nature of the crime, but they didn't get a context and an explanation for how that addiction developed and how it impacted him, as Dr. Pritchard and Ms. Johnson did.
But that wouldn't have impacted or affected the ultimate step. How you do this in mitigation. In other words, what we have from the trial court is having considered the same things on the non-statutory mitigation side, but I think more relevantly, having weighed it is only giving them some weight. In other words, to the finder of fact here, to the ultimate determiner here, the ultimate determiner said these facts, however you consider them, are only entitled to some weight in the overall calculus. The sentencing judge gave far more weight to the remorse and the fact that he had pled guilty, correct?
Correct. What I would say as to prejudice, though, is so at the penalty phase, given Dr. Larson's testimony and the evidence, the trial court obviously found five aggravating factors to the defense side, zero statutory mitigating factors. And so our point with prejudice is that if counsel had, instead of retaining Dr. Larson, who was not an addiction specialist, who admitted he did little addiction work, if counsel instead had retained experts who could do specific substance abuse testing on Mr. Guardado, Dr. Pritchard, who is a frequent state expert, Ms. Johnson, who administered tests that Mr. Guardado never did, they could have established these two statutory mitigating circumstances. And the importance of that, I think, is a few things. Statutory mitigating circumstances are weightier than non-statutory mitigating circumstances.
As a matter of law, that's true? That doesn't seem to be correct as a matter of law. In other words, there could be a non-statutory, for instance, having pled guilty here, which is far, far weightier than, even though he meets the technical elements of a statutory factor, really is sort of not seen as all that credible or is seen as sort of excusing what otherwise would be a very credible, I did it, I'm sorry, I'm pleading for mercy, and please have mercy on me because I admitted what I did.
Well, the reason I say that, Judge Luck, and I agree there is not a firm decision out there from the Florida Supreme Court or this court that draws the distinction, but I would point to Porter v. McCollum, and in that case, the Supreme Court described non-statutory mitigation as mitigation that does not, quote, rise to the level of statutory mitigation. The other thing is the Florida Supreme Court has said that these two...
Am I right? There are 19 non-statutory mitigators here?
Correct, but counsel only asked for 10. The state suggested 2, and the trial court found the remaining 7 based only on Dr. Larson's report, which the jury didn't have. Had the jury had that report, they may have come back with a less than unanimous recommendation, which could have then affected the trial judge. And we certainly know, and I think you can consider this for purposes of Strickland prejudice, that had even one juror voted for life, this death sentence would have been vacated in 2017.
I don't see how we can consider that.
Well, so Judge, like the reason I say that is in Strickland, the court talks about a reasonable probability of a different outcome, and then it also says including appellate outcomes to the extent that the appellate court reweighs aggravators and mitigators.
I know, but you're asking us for a counter hypothetical of if he had done that and if he had allowed his attorney to then file an appeal, not a given the history of this particular defendant, and the Florida Supreme Court had gotten to that in time, and that it was done during this window as opposed to the post-pool window when they went back on that, it just asks us to ask a lot of different counterfactuals that I don't know we can do in a reasonable probability determination.
Yes, I understand that concern, but the point I would make is assume everything else remains the same. He gets an 11-1. Nothing else changes about the litigation except Mr. Guardado did seek Hearst relief in 2017, and the Florida Supreme Court specifically said, we are applying Hearst to this case, but under our unanimous recommendation rule, it's harmless. So I think there's no question that in that case, in that specific appeal, had there been an 11-1, this death sentence would be vacated. Every single other Florida defendant post-Ring with a split jury vote had their death sentence vacated that year. So I do think that's something we should consider for outcome purposes.
Go ahead.
Please.
You want to follow up on that point?
No, I didn't.
So it seems to me, if I'm understanding you correctly, that the crux of your prejudice argument has to do with the difference between non-statutory mitigator number 16 under emotional distress and number 17 does not suffer a mental illness. Could you explain how what the experts were going to say was so different in terms of statutory mitigators that would cause prejudice?
So it's not just that they're statutory versus non-statutory. These particular
right.
statutory mitigators, as I mentioned, the Florida Supreme Court has described these mental mitigators as some of the most weighty. And remember, one of the aggravators that was found was the cold, calculated, premeditated. And this court in Hardwick noted that when you have the statutory mitigators of the extreme emotional disturbance and unable to conform, that undermines the CCP aggravator. So now we're talking about going from 5 aggravators and 0 statutory mitigators to possibly 4 aggravators and 2 statutory mitigators. And I think that could have fundamentally, had the jury heard all that, altered the jury's decision-making and the jury vote, and had the judge had that, the judge may have imposed a different sentence.
But what if we set aside the difference between, I understand your argument about statutory versus non-statutory, what's the qualitative difference between what the district court found and recognized here and what those experts were saying?
Well, I think as I mentioned, the jury and the trial judge heard there was no mental illness here. Dr. Larson actually says the court should find it mitigating that there's no mental illness here. And what Dr. Pritchard and Ms. Johnson find is there is, as defined in the DSM, a mental illness based on the substance abuse. There's cocaine psychosis that Mr. Guardado could not conform his actions on the night of the murder. That's a fundamentally different picture than the jury and the trial judge got.
I'm interested in the Caritelli issue. So the juror issue, if you can move on to that.
Yes.
So if you would start by explaining to me why you think the Florida Supreme Court did not reasonably apply Strickland prejudice with regard to the juror issue, and then if you'd then get on to why you would win, assuming I agree with you, de novo, if we did a de novo review.
Sure. So, you know, I think the briefs were talking past a little each other on this, and respondent has put forth a lot of arguments on the assumption that we are asking for presumed prejudice, which was litigated in several cases, and it was found that you can't default an objection on that basis and then try to get the presumed prejudice in post-conviction. We're not asking for that. We just want the same Strickland standard, as this court said in Harvey, that applies to every other claim, and in this case, that would be whether this court has its confidence in this outcome undermined.
Tell me this. I was confused a bit about this. Is it one peremptory that was left?
Yes.
And we're talking about three different jurors. And is your argument dependent on a for-cause objection to at least some of the jurors? I mean, it seemed to me if the assumption is that all three should have been struck, but there was only one peremptory left, then I don't see how that makes any sense. I'm just trying to figure that out.
We do not assert that counsel needed to strike all three jurors for this outcome to be different. Okay. Even if one juror had been taken off this jury, which unquestionably counsel could have done with the remaining peremptory, the whole dynamic in the jury room could have changed. It's the
could that I'm having the biggest problem with, because you're required to do more than that, and I agree with you. The standard would be just reasonable probability of a different result.
Yeah.
How can you get to reasonable probability based on the transcript and the record that we have?
Well, I think we would just say that given what these jurors put out there in terms of bias, part of our claim and part of where this got confused with Caritelli is we are not just asserting that counsel should have challenged jurors for cause, and we're not just asserting that he should have used this one remaining peremptory. And by the way, Mr. Gonterra, counsel...
So are you saying both of those things? That's part of what I was trying to get at. Are you saying that a couple of the jurors should have been challenged for cause and that a peremptory should have been used on the other?
Our argument is that Mr. Gonterra's voir dire of these jurors did not probe their biases.
All right, so now we're getting into something, because I know there's an argument about this. You got to show me where in the state court record
you made that
there's
argument.
An ineffective assistance of voir dire.
Voir dire. Is there an ineffective assistance claim about voir dire? I'm not aware of that.
In the state court record?
Yes.
Well, I think it's inherent in this idea of whether you...
That's not inherent. I mean, those are different things. They just are. You were ineffective in questioning jurors is different than you were ineffective in exercising a strike because of something you did question them on and an answer that
right.
that they gave. Those are different things.
Yeah.
Okay, I take your point, Judge.
So I focusing on the claim that I think was brought, which is the one that I think the Chief Judge described to you.
Yes.
How can we find, and I'm assuming
I'm
you're
still,
right.
I would still like an answer to my question. I'm still not sure. Are you saying that two strikes for cause should have been made and are peremptory? Or are you complaining, are you just saying this is only about a peremptory strike? I'm confused about that.
The argument we have made in the briefs, and I take Judge Lutz's point that this, your view is that this is not exhausted in the state courts. The argument we made in the brief is that counsel heard these indications of biases from these jurors. So, for example, the juror who had known the victim and met with her, talked to her a few times a week over several months and called her a very nice lady. The counsel's reaction to that was not to further probe those kinds of biases. And so had counsel performed effectively and strategically exercised, developed a record sufficient for cause challenges.
That's different from the actual strikes, isn't it? I mean, now it seems like you're getting back into an argument about counsel should have elicited more information.
Yes, that was our argument in this court.
The problem is on the argument that I think was raised, it's hard to find prejudice there. So I'll just give you an example. Let's go to Ms. Pennington, the one that you just talked about. So Ms. Pennington was asked, quote, this is at docket entry 17-10 at 82, with the fact that you developed at least this business relationship, the one you just referred to with her, do you think that it would affect your ability to be fair and impartial in deciding whether the person who murdered her, Mr. Guidardo, should or should not receive the death penalty? Answer, I think I could be fair. Then follow up. The real question is, could you, Mr. Guidardo, could you assure Mr. Guidardo that you could be fair and make a fair and legal decision based on whether or not the state proved that aggravating circumstances exist which outweigh the mitigating circumstances, the whole point of the sentencing? Answer, yes. The question, Ms. Pennington, are you going to be able to set aside those feelings or that business relationship that you had with Ms. Malone and make your decision based on the law and the evidence and not reflect back on any conversation you may have had with her? Answer, yes, sir. It was just business knowing her. It wasn't, and then dot, 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 because a new question was answered. And then later, that's not going to affect your ability to render a fair and impartial decision in this case. Question, answer, no, sir, it doesn't. I mean, I just don't know where we find evidence to find by a reasonable probability that the result would have been different if Ms. Pennington wasn't on the jury.
I take your point, Judge. As I said, our argument was premised on the cause angle of as to Mr. the counsel further developing information on the record. If the court doesn't find that, then we would assert that a peremptory should have been used on a juror like that. I know that there was a hypothetical.
But there's only one peremptory.
He had one peremptory, but he did testify later that he would have asked for more peremptories if he thought he needed them. So I don't think that the one peremptory, and as I mentioned, I don't think that we need to do the bean
count. But we have to assume that he could have exercised three?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we should.
We don't make that assumption, then what's your best one?
Excuse me, Judge?
What's your best one? What's your best peremptory?
Which juror is the most prejudicial?
Juror Pennington, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Millsaps.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Charmaine Millsaps representing the Secretary. I'll also talk first about the mitigation. I divided that into two in my answer brief. The first one regarding presenting one expert and the second one about 10 mitigation witnesses. That's what happened in state court.
I'm not 100% sure that's right, and I don't know the exact answer to this, so I'm asking it. So as I understand it, the way that this was litigated in front of the state habeas court was you failed to call 9, and I think they ended up using 10 mitigation witnesses that you knew you had but didn't call them, and they were available. And then you didn't present all of the psychological mitigation evidence you could have. You could have called these other two psychologists to testify. That's the way this was litigated at the state habeas court. You agree?
Yes, I do agree with that. And the one was Mrs. Johnson, who was who had an expertise in...
She was an addiction counselor.
Yes,
right.
She was an addiction counselor.
Then we get to the Florida Supreme Court, and if you read their brief, it is very similar to the arguments that counsel makes here. Their brief does talk about failure to investigate, not following up on red flags, those sorts of things. And the Florida Supreme Court, in its decision, seemed to talk about and describe the claim as a failure to investigate and a failure to follow up and do some of these things. So do we take that as having been preserved because the Florida Supreme Court took all of it and rendered a decision and never claimed that it was outside the scope of what was originally argued below?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose you could do it either way, but I answered it the way it was. My answer brief did it the way I took it. I took it even up here to be really about those two things, that you should have presented better drug experts. And let's get straight, because he talks about
the decision that we're reviewing for habeas purposes
is right, the Florida Supreme Court.
Is the Florida Supreme Court's decision.
It is indeed.
If it addressed the claim, notwithstanding, however, it might have been litigated in the trial court as having been litigated there properly and presented properly, don't we have an obligation to review that decision?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the decision under the AEDPA that is reviewed. It's the state's highest court. to the extent it doesn't disagree, overrule the state lower court. So you defer to both, but here you would defer to the Florida Supreme Court. And that, Your Honor, if you want to, for example, if you're going to do a general failure to investigate, then you're going to also have to take into consideration that Annie Dunham, the investigator, was not called to testify. If you, Your Honor, that claim was that there's a immense failure to prove, a failure of proof on the just general failure to investigate, because the investigator was not called to testify here at the evidentiary hearing. As a matter of fact, the state is the one who even called both counsel and co-counsel. So some general investigator was, it wasn't litigated down below. You're going to have to go beyond the record. I know the Florida Supreme Court, I don't think it
We're not going to go beyond the record.
Yes. So really, you can't go beyond the record under the AEDPA, and the United States Supreme Court recently just reaffirmed that. Anyway, so they were not, the investigator was not presented below. So, and then at least, really, I think if you're going to, I mean, I need to hear more than just a general failure to investigate. What exactly are they talking about on failure to investigate? If you want to talk about the 10 witnesses, seven of them were forfeited because they weren't presented.
Counsel says it in their brief. He talks about there were flags that were done in the Dr. Larson's report, specifically about prior molestation and specifically about a longstanding history of drug abuse that was not investigated and presented to the jury and to the court.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, a lot of that, I'm gonna point out to you. Now, I'm using the Florida Supreme Court's list of the 19 mitigation. Drug was found three different ways, number 8, number 13, and number 16. It was not just arrest. It was also that number 8 was suffered most of his life with an addiction problem, which was given some weight. And then number 13 was he had a long history of substance abuse starting in his early years. That was given little weight. And then the duress one, which was number 16. And one of the things they seem
so that so as I understand you're arguing, that going to prejudice. In other words, to the extent there was a failure to investigate a long history of drug abuse going back to his childhood and to present that to the jury, what you're arguing is the state trial court found these facts as part of its mitigation case and were weighed and considered as part of the ultimate decision of whether to impose the death penalty or not.
Yes, so that would very much go to prejudice. And then you would have to do, and I agree with you very much, Your Honor, the label statutory versus non-statutory does not matter as much as the weight given. For example,
well, it seems odd because every state has different statutory mitigators. So it would seem odd to let the state dictate what the important ones are or not, and that would change for each death penalty state, especially when the Supreme Court has essentially told courts all of it comes in and you need to consider all of it as part of the calculus.
And we have, in effect, Your Honor, I know we talk in terms of statutory and non-statutory, but our number K is a catch-all, okay? We have a catch-all in Florida, and it says, really, in light.
Even if you didn't, you'd have to consider it, as Judge Luck's point. Supreme Court precedent would require you to consider any mitigating circumstance, right?
Absolutely.
Whether you had a catch-all or in your statute or not.
Yes.
The Eighth Amendment would require
and we do.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is even if you, Your Honor, the for Strickland prejudice, what you do with omitted mitigation is you add the omitted mitigation to the mitigation presented. If the state has any counter to it, you take that into consideration.
So
we don't. And then you reweigh. God. And I'm just saying you're gonna still have very many aggravators. And this mitigation,
so
there's no evidence that the weight would be
counsel,
changed.
So in oral argument we discussed and my colleague Judge Jill Pryor asked about the findings that there was no mental health problems, which was actually part of the mitigation case, frankly, whereas Now it's presented at the state habeas evidentiary hearing that he did, in fact, have mental health problems that should have been considered and, if weighed, may have led to a different decision. That's as I understand the argument that's been made here.
And I'd very much like to address that. I disagree with all of that. So let me start with Dr. Larson was not just presented for remorse, which he definitely was, and for drug. A huge part of theirs was skipper evidence. And that's what defense counsel argued to the jury. That was a huge part of it. Look, this guy, Guardado, doesn't do well outside prison. Put him back in prison. And Dr. Larson was going to be able and did testify that he's not a psychopath and he'll do just fine. So a huge part of this mitigation case, I'm going to call Skipper. And it was found multiple ways as well. And given moderate weight, look at number three. I'm reading from the 19, but I'm doing it from the Florida Supreme Court's opinion.
I understand.
Okay. So, and what they're really classifying, I took the mental mitigation is really just that both of their experts in post-conviction said the drug use itself rise to that level. I don't think they're arguing that Guardado was a psychopath, contrary to what Dr. Larson testified to. And so understand Dr. Larson's, the drug part of it was almost number three. We need to also talk very much. Dr. Larson helped them immensely on remorse. He was allowed to express his own personal opinion that Guardado was telling him the truth about how remorseful and everything.
I'm not sure you've answered Judge Luck's question, though. There's a big difference between he has no mental health issues and he's suffering from a serious emotional disturbance at the time of the crime, such that he may not appreciate the criminality of his behavior. So explain to me why that's not prejudicial.
Okay, so may I rephrase the question to make sure I'm getting it? That somehow what they presented in state court would rise to the level finding at least one of the mental mitigators? But, Your Honor, this is all still just about drug use. I'm not sure that any judge, I don't see any connection between you presenting two experts whose own opinion. Remember, we don't care. We care what the judge is going to find based on that testimony.
Well, Larson affirmatively testified that he was suffering under no mental disability.
Yes.
Had no mental illness.
And that was very useful for the Skipper presentation. Yes, and I don't think they disagreed with that. What they were saying, the experts in state post-conviction were saying, no, that his drug use rises to the level of statutory mental mitigation. They were turning drug use into that level, extreme both for trying to obtain.
And your point is that Larson had testified that he was under considerable stress and on a cocaine binge, and there's not that big a difference between the two? Is that to finish?
Yeah, and Dr. Larson did testify to those things that he was under cocaine.
I'm just trying to understand the argument, Ms. Millsaps, okay? Instead of you saying, and Dr. Larson did. Is that right? Is that your response to it?
That yes, he did.
I mean, you, all right, so.
I'm not sure
I am. I'm as frustrated, I think, as maybe some of my colleagues are. And so it's one, if we understand the argument to be that he was not suffering under any kind of mental disorder, this is what happens at trial. And then in post-conviction, there are experts who'd say that he did. You're as I understood what you were just saying a moment ago, you were responding that, well, the mental health experts who testified in post-conviction said that what he was really suffering from was a substance abuse addiction that rose to the level of a mental health mitigator. And if you look at, and so that's helpful to know that, okay?
Yes.
That's one difference in the way the question was presented. And I'm now trying to understand the significance of that, okay? And it seemed to me that perhaps the significance, your argument is that notwithstanding what was presented as
Dr. Larson's testimony, not that, that Guardado wasn't suffering from a mental health disorder. Larson nevertheless did testify that he was, that Guardado was on a cocaine binge and was under considerable stress. And there's not a big difference between that and the mental health mitigator that was actually presented in state post-conviction. Is that right?
With the added thing that I don't think it changes the weight, and for there to be any prejudice, you would have to change the weight, not just the label.
Okay?
It's not like they had some different psychological diagnosis that they presented from Dr. Pritchard. Dr. Pritchard did not, for example, testify, yes, he is a psychopath. And incidentally, you wouldn't want Dr. Pritchard to testify to that because that would undermine your Skipper evidence.
What he testified to, as I understand, was, and both of them did, which is, I don't disagree with the input that Judge Larson, that Dr. Larson did. I disagree with the output. In other words, the information that he considered is similar information to what I consider. I just believe, or my conclusion is a little different than his, right?
Yes, their conclusions were different. On the same basic substance of drug abuse, Dr. Larson said it was non-statutory, and they said it was statutory. It's a matter of extreme, of degrees. They said it was to such a degree that it should have been found as
and it's
statutory.
Part of, and this is part of why the argument you made in your brief, as I understood it, was it's almost as if the complaint is about ineffective assistance by experts as opposed to counsel.
If you read their brief submitted in the state courts, a great deal of it was saying that attacking Dr. Pritchard's qualifications. He'd only 5%.
Dr. Larson's qualifications?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Dr. Larson's qualifications, who was the expert they presented.
I'd like to get to the juror issue, if you don't mind. I have to tell you, I'm only speaking for myself. I have not talked to my colleagues about this, but I have a big problem with how the Florida Supreme Court is applying the Strickland standard in ineffective assistance and failure to use cause challenges or failure to strike somebody for cause. It seems to me inconsistent with Strickland. Why am I wrong?
Well, Your Honor, because it would have to be a different outcome. And the United States Supreme Court, even in direct appeals, requires a showing of actual bias.
Now we're talking about prejudice, I think.
We are talking about prejudice, but let's go back. So I want to unpack that because there's a lot there. So you're referring to the McDonough Power case, correct?
I am, Your Honor.
That's a juror misconduct case, is it not?
A failure to disclose during jury selection.
We don't have that, do we?
That's not the issue.
Okay. No, we do not have that.
Counsel, so we don't have that. So the comparator, it seems to me, and I'm speaking to someone who knows more Florida law than I possibly could, it seems to me is the Trotter-Busby line of cases under Florida law, which says that where there's a failure to strike for cause, where there is in fact cause, and that juror serves, and the counsel seeks a peremptory and doesn't get one from the trial court. In other words, they utilize all the peremptories. They've asked for more. Trial court says, no, you're not getting any more. And that juror serves. That standard is a presumed prejudice standard, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, under Busby in that.
Yes.
So you would be incorporating Florida law as the prejudice.
I'm just telling you, I'm asking you, in Florida court, if you were to appeal this directly, because that's your argument, right? That on direct appeal, the standard is higher, and so it can't be lower on an habeas. That makes a lot of sense under Weaver. But the problem is the premise of your argument is that this is a McDonough case, and this is not a McDonough case. It's not a McDonough Power. We're in a failure to strike for cause, and on direct appeal in Florida, for the failure to strike for cause, prejudice is presumed under the facts that I laid out, correct?
Yes, but
here, under Strickland, we're not presuming prejudice. As counsel, I think, well articulated while he was up here, we're requiring you to show prejudice. That's a higher standard. That's not Weaver. right?
They're saying they're not presuming prejudice, but, Your Honor, in the context of jury selection, they're not telling me, you at least said, let's look at Busby. My comeback to that is a direct appeal.
Right.
Your Honor, we got Caritelli from this court, Purvis.
Right. The Florida Supreme Court was wrong. It happens. They lifted a juror misconduct direct appeal issue that had its basis in McDonough Power and substituted that in an ineffective assistance counsel claim with regard to failure to utilize a cause strike when that was when you should have utilized a cause strike. That's a problem.
Okay, but what is the standard for a for cause challenge? It's actual bias.
Show me where. So I know in state law it's not because we just went through it in Busby Trotter. It's presumed. Show me where in federal law on a direct appeal issue. And when I mean federal, I mean the U.S. Supreme Court has said that a failure to utilize cause, you're required to show actual prejudice where that issue is
actual
brought up.
Actual bias.
Actual bias.
Okay, there is. They don't do the peremptory part of it. They don't do it all.
Follow me. I'm only talking about cause challenges.
Okay, cause challenges on direct appeal
yes. In
Florida, you would be fine. But Florida is entitled to increase its standard to actual bias. I do not
where,
have to
where's, show me where your any state is allowed to just say, we understand what Strickland says, and ADEPA says you have to reasonably apply Supreme Court decisions. But state, you're allowed to take Strickland prejudice and turn it into whatever you feel like. Where do we get that from?
Well, I'm getting it from no less than this court in Owen saying the only way there would be a different outcome is if there was a biased juror.
We didn't right. If you could show a reasonable probability that a biased juror was there. But we didn't decide this issue in Owen.
We deferred judgment on this very question.
Right.
We deferred judgment in Owen on the question whether the Caritelli actual bias test for prejudice imposes a higher burden or contradicts the governing Strickland prejudice standard. That's what we said.
And then Owen goes on, and what's it actually use? It says, for there to be a different outcome under Strickland, which is the prejudice language, the juror would have to be biased. Well, so that's what they actually did, and then you did it again in Teasley.
No, what they did is they applied... You're confusing two things. What the standard is and what evidence was sufficient in Owen are two separate and different things. In Owen, they looked to bias to see if it was there, but they didn't say as a matter of law to meet the prejudice standard, you needed actual bias. In fact, they said the exact opposite. We're not deciding that very issue. So at the end of the day, I'm having trouble finding, if we apply Strickland de novo, that there was a reasonable probability of a different result here. But what I'm trying to ask you questions about, and I'm having a hard time, is trying to understand how the Florida Supreme Court's decision in this case is consistent with Strickland.
Because, Your Honor, any standard lower than actual bias doesn't even make any sense in terms of
prejudice. Why is that the case?
No United States Supreme Court, not just McDonough Power, but the rest of them all talk about actual bias because they say that is the standard for a for-cause challenge. It's not something
show
else.
Show me the Supreme Court case on a for-cause challenge that says the standard to meet it is actual bias.
That's McDonough Power.
That's a juror misconduct case. That's a case where a juror doesn't disclose information. And that misconduct is then judged later on in a new trial motion to see whether we're going to grant a new trial or not. We don't have juror misconduct in this case. This is not a juror misconduct case. This is the problem. Both you and the Florida Supreme Court have mashed up a standard for one thing and put it in a standard for another thing. And that's why we're in the boat that we're in right now. So I'm going to go back to the question I did ask, which is, show me a United States Supreme Court case, because we know in Florida it's presumed prejudice under Trotter and Busby. So show me a U.S. Supreme Court case that has applied in a direct appeal an actual bias standard for the failure to exercise a cause challenge.
So that would have to be a Strickland claim.
No,
for failure to exercise.
Direct appeal.
Well,
So, but I've never seen, it doesn't come up, because the failure would be by counsel. It would always come. How would that come up?
I guess. Let me see if I can fix this problem. Is your concern is that if it's the actual bias standard and a for-cause challenge and it's on direct appeal, that's an issue of state law and not federal law?
Well, if you transfer Busby, then no, yes. No.
I'm not asking Strickland to transfer anything. I'm just asking this. Judge Luck was asking for a direct appeal review by the Supreme Court of the United States on an actual bias for cause challenge, you know, where you apply actual bias as the standard. And it seems to me maybe the answer for why you don't get a Supreme Court decision on that point is that's an issue of Florida law, not federal law.
Well,
is that right?
But, Your Honor, how about Pena Rodriguez? Why don't we talk about Pena Rodriguez? Because in Pena,
do you have ineffective assistance claims on direct appeal?
Yes, they do juror. The juror should have been removed. That the juror should have
been
removed.
That's an ineffective assistance claim?
On direct appeal, the juror should have been removed because they were actually biased for some reason.
Right.
Okay.
But that's an issue of state law, isn't it?
Busby is definitely state law. Yes, Busby is state law. But no, I think the standard on the direct appeal, if you were in federal, it would be actual bias. Now, we do lower, for example, we do De La Rosa as state law. We also do it close.
Isn't that because these sorts of jury selection issues outside of race selection and things are not constitutionalized? I think that's what the Chief Judge is asking you. A straight for-cause challenge, every state has a separate statute. Florida has its own that sets out here are the for-cause challenges. That's not federal constitutional law. Right. That's just a matter of state law.
Right.
Yes, the particular grounds, for instance, whether somebody with a conviction would be disqualified or not.
Right.
Yes, those kind of things. But I think most the United States Supreme Court, every time I've seen them deal with a jury selection, the standard that they use is actual bias.
You can't cite a decision of the Supreme Court in the ineffective assistance context that applies that.
No, Your Honor, I do not know one from the United States
and
Supreme Court.
And that's Judge Luck's problem here, is that it appears that the Florida Supreme Court is taking that standard and applying it in the Strickland context where it may not, in fact, apply. And there is no Supreme Court precedent support for that.
The closest I would say is that you can have a higher standard, which Florida does. Caritelli is...
Not in habeas, though, right? I mean, in habeas, if we are evaluating ineffective assistance, they have to apply the federal standard for prejudice.
Okay, I need to separate them. A state can have a very loosey standard, such as De La Rosa. Okay, that's state law. It can have a very loose standard on direct appeal, including...
But where it's an issue of state law.
That is an issue of state law, things like De La Rosa. Our standard of Singer and Lusk is that if it's even close to bias, not actual bias, just close to bias, then that should have been granted and we will give you a new trial, okay? Now, as a matter of state law, can we say those two very loosey direct appeal standards, De La Rosa, we're not gonna use at all. Can we have higher in post-conviction? So the higher is in state court. When I use the word higher, I mean state law changes from, quite frankly, some of the most, we grant more new trials on direct appeal than almost anybody else. Then, but you get higher in post-conviction, and we're going to require actual bias.
What you're talking about is Weaver, and what Weaver says is that's okay, where the difference is that you would get a better standard on habeas than you had on direct appeal. That's when Weaver allows a state to have a higher standard for habeas otherwise. That's what Weaver said. That's what you're talking about. Right. But that doesn't apply here, assuming Trotter and Busby are the correct standard, the comparator, Trotter and Busby are down here, and the Strickland reasonable probability standard on the prejudice is up here. In other words, the higher standard is on habeas, not on direct appeal. So you don't have the Weaver problem. That's the issue that I'm struggling with, and that I think is the faulty premise of your argument. But counsel, I want to get past it because you only have about 2 minutes left.
Okay.
And so far, frankly, it hasn't been all that helpful to me, the conversation. So
me neither.
Let's assume that de novo review applies here.
All right.
So apply Strickland de novo without an actual bias standard. Okay? That's the hypothetical.
Okay.
You understand? Tell me why you would win.
Well, I have a factual finding from the Florida Supreme Court that, but that was on actual bias.
Right. So that's wrong. So let's not focus
okay,
on
okay. So de novo would be the juror that they pointed to was Pennington. So let me talk to you about Pennington. Anything having to do with guilt in this case was totally off the table. He entered a guilty plea. Guardado entered a guilty plea. The only thing before counsel, and counsel was picking jurors based on life versus death and penalty phase, because that's the only thing he was doing. This juror was somewhat in favor of the death penalty, given three options, slightly, somewhat, and strongly. Okay, Pennington said somewhat. She was a good juror for penalty phase. And counsel is entitled, and he said he was, everybody, when you're only trying a penalty phase, all you really care about is the penalty phase, because that's all you're doing.
But their response is, there was pretty overwhelming evidence that she had a pre-existing relationship with this juror. And it would seem to be deficient that you'd want a juror who knew the victim and didn't just know the victim in passing, but knew the victim to such an extent that they had weekly dealings for a month or two while she was helping her son buy some apartment from the victim 2 or 3 years before the crime in this case.
This court's case in Harvey, the jury question there was 10 times off the scale compared to knowing having a business relationship with the victim, which quite frankly, in smaller areas, that kind of thing happens a lot. She guaranteed that she would put that aside and it wouldn't affect her her decision.
That's the dispositive question, isn't it?
I think the somewhat overrides everything is what I'm saying, Your Honor. Okay? That's both, my argument goes both to deficient performance and prejudice on that.
Ms. Millsaps, there's something about your brief that's been a recurring issue that I see with several Florida lawyers. I do not understand why they all use all caps and very long headings. They're very difficult for me to read. Maybe it's my advanced age. I don't know. But my eyesight's pretty good. And those all cap headings and subheadings are impossible to read.
I'll spread that around, Your Honor. I don't use all caps for my subheadings, but I will spread that
around.
Well, you
did it for your headings.
Okay. I will not do it.
I can't read it. I mean, they're like several lines long, all caps. It's impenetrable.
I will spread that around, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. We ask you to affirm the Florida Supreme Court's decision.
Well, or the district court's decision. Mr. Gunn, you've saved 8 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just have a few brief points I want to make about the mitigation issue that I just don't want to escape the court's attention. Number one, we have no dispute with counsel presenting the remorse and acceptance of responsibility. Our only point here is that presenting some mitigation and deciding on what mitigation to present doesn't excuse the responsibility to conduct a thorough investigation of everything else. And so I don't think there was a reasonable strategic decision here to focus on remorse and responsibility because the rest of the case was not fully investigated. The second thing, Ms. Millsaps referred to the investigator not testifying. I did want to know, I do believe in Mr. Gonterik's testimony, he describes what the investigator did. She interviewed one employer and that employer didn't have mitigation to offer or wouldn't have been helpful in mitigation. Number three, as to the non-statutory and statutory distinction, I may have said this before, but I just wanted to emphasize that to Judge Luck's point about how it would be difficult because different states define statutory differently, I did just want to emphasize, and I think we cited the case Rose in our briefs, where the Florida Supreme Court has said that these specific statutory mitigators are weightier. So for this particular state, I think those should be taken as weightier. My final point on the statutory, just on the label, I do think that even if we assume that there's no legal basis to find them more important, I do think the statutory circumstances carry the seal of the legislature and will be seen by the jury and the judge as more impactful. So I do think just on that basis.
A juror wouldn't know statutory versus non, right?
Well, I believe they are instructed on the circumstances.
On the circumstances, but they're not told these are statutory with the legislature's imprimatur and these are not, right? I'm pretty familiar with the pattern capital instructions. Point me to something if I'm missing it, but are they told that some are statutory and some are not?
I've not seen that in this particular record.
It would be a problem if they were told that, wouldn't it? Because the Eighth Amendment requires that they consider any mitigating circumstance, and to the extent that you suggested that some had the imprimatur of the legislature and were entitled to more because of that, that could pose an Eighth Amendment problem, it seems to me.
I take your point on that, Judge, and I don't have any specific. I just wanted to make the point that I think, as to the judge may see it as more impactful and it could have affected his decision. The idea that a respondent raises and the court was discussing about how Dr. Larson did testify to the cocaine binge, I just wanted to highlight that he did testify that Mr. Guardado was on a cocaine binge and that was the basis for the crimes, but I don't think he gave the jury or the judge any context for what a cocaine binge is, what that does to your mental state of mind in terms of the science of addiction and the DSM. And so I think just the fact that he had mentioned the cocaine binge is not as much as Dr. Pritchard.
That really does get to the heart of the issue that we were trying to nail down with your opposing counsel, which was that your experts testified that there was an addiction problem here that Dr. Larson did not identify, right?
Well, it's a little confusing because Dr. Larson's report actually says he has a chemical dependency on cocaine, and that was the basis for the crimes. And I think he repeats something similar in his testimony, but then okay. At one point he throws out, "I don't consider him an addict." So I think that was a confusing message for the jury that wouldn't have happened if counsel had...
But my point is what you presented in post-conviction was that this mental health mitigator is that he had an addiction.
Yes. Yes, okay. Correct. unless the court has any more questions, the rest of my briefs. Yeah. Thank you. We ask that the district court be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn. We have your case, and we'll be adjourned for the afternoon.